Hutchins had warned Strike that he might not always be fit. It was, he explained, an unpredictable disease, but he had not relapsed in 3 years. He followed a special low-fat diet that to Strike sounded positively punitive. No red meat, no cheese, no chocolate, nothing deep-fried. Methodical and patient, Andy could be trusted to get the job done without constant supervision, which was more than could be said for any of Strike's other hires apart from Robin. It seemed incredible to him, still, that she had walked into his life as a temporary secretary to become his partner and outstanding colleague. Whether they were still friends, though, was another question. 2 days after Robin and Matthew's wedding, when the press had driven him out of his flat, while it was still impossible to turn on the TV without hearing his own name, Strike had sought refuge, in spite of invitations from friends and his sister, in a travel lodge near Monument Station. There he had attained the solitude and privacy he craved. There he had been free to sleep for hours undisturbed. And there he had downed 9 cans of lager and become increasingly desirous of speaking to Robin with each empty can that he threw, with diminishing accuracy, across the room into the bin. They had had no contact since their hug on the stairs, to which Strike's thoughts had returned repeatedly in the ensuing days. He was sure that Robin would be going through a hellish time, holed up in Masham, while deciding whether to pursue a divorce or an annulment, arranging for the sale of their flat while dealing with both press and family fallout. What exactly he was going to say when he reached her, Strike did not know. He only knew that he wanted to hear her voice. It was at this point, drunkenly searching his kit bag, that he discovered that in his sleep-deprived haste to leave his flat, he had not packed a recharging lead for his mobile, which was out of battery. Undeterred, he had dialed directory inquiries and succeeded, after many requests, to repeat himself more clearly in getting connected to Robin's parents' house. Her father had answered.
"Hi. Can I speak to Robin, please?"
"To Robin? I'm afraid she's on her honeymoon."
For a muzzy moment or two, Strike had not quite comprehended what he had been told.
"Hello?"
Michael Ellicott had said,
and then angrily, "I suppose this is another journalist. My daughter's abroad, and I would like you to stop calling my house."
Strike had hung up, then continued to drink until he passed out. His anger and disappointment had lingered for days, and were in no way abated by his awareness that many would say that he had no claims upon his employee's private life. Robin wasn't the woman he had thought her if she could have got meekly on a plane with the man he mentally referred to as that twat. Nevertheless, something close to depression weighed upon him while he sat in his travel lodge, with his brand new recharging lead and more lager, waiting for his name to disappear from the news. Consciously seeking to distract himself from thoughts of Robin, he had ended his self-imposed isolation by accepting an invitation that he would usually have avoided. Dinner with Detective Inspector Eric Wardle, Wardle's wife April, and their friend Coco. Strike knew perfectly well that he was being set up. Coco had previously tried to find out through Wardle whether Strike was single. She was a small, lithe, very pretty girl with tomato red hair, a tattoo artist by trade, and a part-time burlesque dancer. He ought to have read the danger signs. She was giggly and slightly hysterical even before they started drinking. Strike had taken her to bed in the travel lodge in the same way he had drunk 9 cans of Tennent's. Coco had taken some shaking loose in the weeks that followed. Strike did not feel good about it, but one advantage of being on the run from the press was that one-night stands found it far harder to track you down. 1 year on, Strike had no idea why Robin had chosen to remain with Matthew. He supposed her feelings for her husband ran so deep that she was blind to what he really was. He was in a new relationship himself now. It had lasted 10 months, the longest since he had split up with Charlotte, who had been the only woman whom he had ever contemplated marrying. The emotional distance between the detective partners had become a simple fact of daily existence. Strike could not fault Robin's work. She did everything she was told promptly, meticulously, and with initiative and ingenuity, Nevertheless, he had noticed a pinch look that had never been there before. He thought her slightly jumpier than usual, and once or twice while parcelling out work between his partner and subcontractors, he had caught an uncharacteristic blank, unfocused expression that troubled him. He knew some of the signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, and she had now survived two near-fatal attacks. In the immediate aftermath of losing half his leg in Afghanistan, he too had experienced dissociation, finding himself suddenly and abruptly removed from his present surroundings to those few seconds of acute foreboding and terror that had preceded the disintegration of the Viking in which he'd been sitting, and of his body and military career. He had been left with a deep dislike of being driven by anybody else, and to this day, with dreams of blood and agony that sometimes woke him, bathed in sweat. However, when he had attempted to discuss Robin's mental health in the calm, responsible tones of her employer, she had cut him off with a finality and a resentment that he suspected could be traced to the sacking. Thereafter, he had noticed her volunteering for trickier, after-dark assignments, and it had been something of a headache to arrange work so that he did not appear to be trying, as in fact he was, to keep her on the safest, most mundane jobs. They were polite, pleasant, and formal with each other, talking about their private lives in the broadest brushstrokes, and then only when necessary. Robin and Matthew had just moved house, and Strike had insisted that she take a full week off to do it. Robin had been resistant, but Strike had overruled her. She had taken very little leave all year, he reminded her, in a tone that brooked no argument. On Monday, the latest of Strike's unsatisfactory subcontractors, a cocky ex-redcap Strike had not known while in the service, had driven his moped into the rear of a taxi he was supposed to be tailing. Strike had enjoyed sacking him. It had given him somebody on whom to vent his anger, because his landlord had also chosen this week to inform Strike that, along with nearly every other owner of office space in Denmark Street, he had sold out to a developer. The threat of losing both office and home now loomed over the detective. To set the seal on a particularly shitty few days, the temp he had hired to cover basic paperwork and answer the phone in Robin's absence was as irritating a woman as Strike had ever met. Denise talked non-stop in a whiny nasal voice that carried even through the closed door of his inner office. Strike had latterly resorted to listening to music on headphones, with the result that she had had to bang on the door repeatedly and shout before he heard her.
"What?"
"I just found this,"
said Denise, brandishing a scribbled note in front of him.
"It says clinic. There's a word beginning with V in front. The appointment's for half an hour's time. Should I have reminded you?"
Strike saw Robin's handwriting. The first word was indeed illegible.
"No," he said. "Just throw it away."
Mildly hopeful that Robin was quietly seeking professional help for any mental problems she might be suffering, Strike replaced his earphones and returned to the report he was reading, but found it hard to concentrate. He therefore decided to leave early for the interview he had scheduled with a possible new subcontractor. Mainly to get away from Denise, he was meeting the man in his favourite pub. Strike had had to avoid the Tottenham for months in the aftermath of his capture of the Shacklewell Ripper, because journalists had lain in wait for him here, word having got out that he was a regular. Even today he glanced around suspiciously before deciding that it was safe to advance on the bar, order his usual pint of Doom Bar, and retire to a corner table. Partly because he had made an effort to give up the chips that were a staple of his diet, partly because of his workload, Strike was thinner now than he had been a year ago. The weight loss had relieved pressure on his amputated leg, so that both the effort and the relief of sitting were less noticeable. Strike took a swig of his pint, stretching his knee from force of habit and enjoying the relative ease of movement, then opened the cardboard file he had brought with him. The notes within had been made by the idiot who had crashed his moped into the back of the taxi, and they were barely adequate. Strike couldn't afford to lose this client, but he and Hutchins were struggling to cover workload as it was. He urgently needed a new hire, and yet he wasn't entirely sure that the interview he was about to conduct was wise. He had not consulted Robin before making the bold decision to hunt down a man he had not seen for 5 years. And even as the door of the Tottenham opened to admit Sam Barkley, who was punctual to the minute, Strike was wondering whether he was about to make an almighty mistake. He would have known the Glaswegian almost anywhere as an ex-squaddy, with his T-shirt under his thin V-neck jumper, his close-cropped hair, his tight jeans and over-white trainers. As Strike stood up and held out his hand, Barkley, who appeared to have recognised him with similar ease, grinned and said, "Already drinking, eh? Want one?" asked Strike. While waiting for Barkley's pint, he watched the ex-rifleman in the mirror behind the bar. Barkley was only a little over 30, but his hair was prematurely greying. He was otherwise exactly as Strike remembered. Heavy-browed, with large, round blue eyes and a strong jaw, he had the slightly beaky appearance of an affable owl. Strike had liked Barkley, even while working to court-martial him.
"Still smoking?" Strike asked, once he'd handed over the beer and sat down. "Vaping now," said Barkley. "We've had a baby." "Congratulations," said Strike. "On a health kick, then?" "Aye, something like that." "Dealing?"
"I was na dealing," said Barkley hotly. "As you fucking well know, recreational use only, pal."
"Where are you buying it now, then?"
"Online," said Barkley, sipping his pint. "Easy. First time I did it, I thought, this can't fucking work, can it? But then I thought, oh, well, it's an adventure. They send it to you disguised in fag packets and that. Choose off a whole menu. Internet's a great thing."
He laughed and said,
"So what's this all about? Wasn't he expecting to hear from you any time soon?"
Strike hesitated.
"I was thinking of offering you a job."
There was a beat as Barkley stared at him. Then he threw back his head and roared with laughter.
"Fuck," he said. "Why didn't you say that straight off, like?"
"Why do you think?"
"I'm no vaping every night," said Barkley earnestly. "I'm no, seriously. The wife doesn't like it."
Strike kept his hand closed on the file, thinking. He had been working a drugs case in Germany when he had run across Barkley. Drugs were bought and sold within the British Army, as in every other part of society. But the Special Investigation Branch had been called in to investigate what appeared to be a rather more professional operation than most. Barkley had been fingered as a key player, and the discovery of a kilo brick of prime Moroccan hash among his effects had certainly justified an interview. Barkley insisted that he had been stitched up, and Strike, who was sitting in on his interrogation, was inclined to agree, not least because the rifleman seemed far too intelligent not to have found a better hiding place for his hashish than the bottom of an army kit bag. On the other hand, there was ample evidence that Barkley had been using regularly, and there was more than one witness to the fact that his behaviour was becoming erratic. Strike felt that Barkley had been lined up as a convenient scapegoat, and decided to undertake a little side excavation on his own. This threw up interesting information relating to building materials and engineering supplies that were being reordered at a thoroughly implausible rate. While it was not the first time that Strike had uncovered this kind of corruption, it so happened that the two officers in charge of these mysteriously vanishing and highly resaleable commodities were the very men so keen to secure Barkley's court-martial. Barkley was startled, during a one-to-one interview with Strike, to find the SIB sergeant suddenly interested, not in hashish, but in anomalies relating to building contracts. At first wary, and sure he would not be believed given the situation in which he found himself, Barkley finally admitted to Strike that he had not only noticed what others had failed to see or chosen not to inquire into, but began to tabulate and document exactly how much these officers were stealing. Unfortunately for Barkley, the officers in question had got wind of the fact that he was a little too interested in their activities, and it was shortly after this that a kilo of hashish had turned up in Barkley's effects. When Barkley showed Strike the record he had been keeping, the notebook had been hidden a good deal more skillfully than the hashish, Strike had been impressed by the method and initiative it displayed, given that Barkley had never been trained in investigative technique. asked why he had undertaken the investigation for which nobody was paying, and which had landed him in so much trouble, Barclay had shrugged his broad shoulders and said,
"No right, is it? That's the army they're robbing. Taxpayers' money they're fucking pocketing."
Strike had put in many more hours on the case than his colleagues felt was merited, but finally, with Strike's additional investigations into the matter to add weight, the dossier on his superior's activities that Barclay had compiled led to their conviction. The SIB took credit for it, of course, but Strike had made sure that accusations against Barclay were quietly laid to rest.
"When you say work,"
Barclay wondered aloud now, as the pub hummed and tinkled around them,
"you mean detective stuff?"
Strike could see that the idea appealed.
"Yeah," said Strike. "What have you been doing since I last saw you?"
The answer was depressing, though not unexpected. Barclay had found it hard to get or keep a regular job in the first couple of years out of the army, and had been doing a bit of painting and decorating for his brother-in-law's company.
"The wife's bringing in most of the money," he said. "She's got a good job."
"Okay," said Strike. "I reckon I can give you a couple of days a week for starters. You'll bill me as a freelancer. If it doesn't work out, either of us can walk away at any time. Sound fair?"
"Aye," said Barclay. "Aye, fair enough. What you paying like?"
They discussed money for 5 minutes. Strike explained how his other employees set themselves up as private contractors, and how receipts and other professional expenses should be brought into the office for reimbursement. Finally, he opened the file and slid it around to show Barclay the contents.
"I need this guy followed," he said, pointing out a photograph of a chubby youth with thick curly hair. "Pictures of whoever he's with and what he's up to."
"Aye, all right," said Barclay, getting out his mobile and taking pictures of the target's photograph and address.
"He's being watched today by my other guy," said Strike, "but I need you outside his flat from 6 o'clock tomorrow morning."
He was pleased to note that Barclay did not query the early start.
"What happened to that lassie, though?"
Barclay inquired, as he put his phone back into his pocket.
"The one who was in the papers with ye?"
"Robin," said Strike. "She's on holiday. Back next week."
They parted with a handshake, Strike enjoying a moment's fleeting optimism before remembering that he would now have to return to the office, which meant proximity to Denise, with her parrot-like chatter, her habit of talking with her mouth full, and her inability to remember that he detested pale, milky tea. He had to pick his way through the ever-present roadworks at the top of Tottenham Court Road to get back to his office. Waiting until he was past the noisiest stretch, he called Robin to tell her that he had hired Barclay, but his call went straight to voicemail. Remembering that she was supposed to be at the mysterious clinic right now, he cut the call without leaving a message. Walking on, a sudden thought occurred to him. He had assumed that the clinic related to Robin's mental health, but what if... The phone in his hand rang, the office number.
"Hello?"
"Mr. Strike," said Denise's terrified squawk in his ear. "Mr. Strike, could you come back quickly, please? Please, there's a gentleman, he wants to see you very urgently."
Behind her, Strike heard a loud bang and a man shouting.
"Please come back as soon as you can,"
screamed Denise.
"On my way,"
Strike shouted, and he broke into an ungainly run. Chapter 2 "He doesn't look the sort of man one ought to allow in here." Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Panting, his right knee aching, Strike used a handrail to pull himself up the last few steps of the metal staircase leading to his office. Two raised voices were reverberating through the glass door, one male, the other shrill, frightened, and female. When Strike burst into the room, Denise, who was backed against the wall, gasped,
"Oh, thank God!"
Strike judged the man in the middle of the room to be in his mid-twenties. Dark hair fell in straggly wisps around a thin and dirty face that was dominated by burning, sunken eyes. His T-shirt, jeans and hoodie were all torn and filthy, the sole of one of his trainers peeling away from the leather. An unwashed animal stench hit the detective's nostrils. That the stranger was mentally ill could be in no doubt. Every 10 seconds or so, in what seemed to be an uncontrollable tick, he touched first the end of his nose, which had grown red with repeated tapping, then, with a faint hollow thud, the middle of his thin sternum, then let his hand drop to his side. Almost immediately, his hand would fly to the tip of his nose again. It was as though he had forgotten how to cross himself, or had simplified the action for speed's sake. Nose, chest, hand at his side. Nose, chest, hand at his side. The mechanical movement was distressing to watch, and the more so as he seemed barely conscious that he was doing it. He was one of those ill and desperate people you saw in the capital who were always somebody else's problem. Like the traveller on the tube everybody tried to avoid making eye contact with, and the ranting woman on the street corner whom people crossed the street to avoid. Fragments of shattered humanity who were too common to trouble the imagination for long.
"You him?"
said the burning-eyed man, as his hand touched nose and chest again.
"You strike. You the detective."
With a hand that was not constantly flying from nose to chest, he suddenly tugged at his flies. Denise whimpered, as if scared he might suddenly expose himself, and indeed it seemed entirely possible.
"I'm Strike, yeah," said the detective, moving around to place himself between the stranger and the temp. "You okay, Denise?"
"Yes,"
she whispered, still backed against the wall.
"I seen a kid killed," said the stranger. "Strangled."
"Okay," said Strike, matter-of-factly. "Why don't we go in here?"
He gestured to him that he should proceed into the inner office.
"I need a piss,"
said the man, tugging at his zip.
"This way, then."
Strike showed him the door to the toilet just outside his office. When the door had banged shut behind him, Strike returned quietly to Denise.
"What happened?"
"He wanted to see you. I said you weren't here, and he got angry and started punching things."
"Call the police," said Strike quietly. "Tell them we've got a very ill man here, possibly psychotic. Wait until I got him into my office, though."
The bathroom door banged open. The stranger's flies were gaping. He did not seem to be wearing underpants. Denise whimpered again as he frantically touched nose and chest, unaware of the large patch of dark pubic hair he was exposing.
"This way," said Strike pleasantly.
The man shuffled through the inner door, the stench of him doubly potent after a brief respite. On being invited to sit down, the stranger perched himself on the edge of the client's chair.
"What's your name?"
Strike asked, sitting down on the other side of the desk.
"Billy,"
said the man, his hand flying from nose to chest 3 times in quick succession. The 3rd time his hand fell, he grabbed it with his other hand and held it tightly.
"And you saw a child strangled, Billy," said Strike. As in the next room, Denise gabbled,
"Please, quickly!" "What does she say?"
asked Billy, his sunken eyes huge in his face, as he glanced nervously towards the outer office, one hand clasping the other in his effort to suppress his tic.
"That's nothing," said Strike easily. "I've got a few different cases on. Tell me about this child."
Strike reached for a pad and paper, all his movements slow and cautious, as though Billy were a wild bird that might take fright.
"He strangled it up by the horse."
Denise was now gabbling loudly into the phone beyond the flimsy partition wall.
"When was this?" asked Strike, still writing.
"Ages. I was a kid. Little girl it was. But after they said it was a little boy. Jimmy was there. He says I never saw it, but I did. I saw him do it. Strangled. I saw it."
"And this was up by the horse, was it?"
"Right up by the horse. That's not where they buried her, though. Him. That was down in the dell by our dad's. I seen them doing it. I can show you the place. She wouldn't let me dig, but she'd let you."
"And Jimmy did it, did he?"
"Jimmy never strangled nobody,"
said Billy angrily.
"He saw it with me. He says it didn't happen, but he's lying. He was there. He's frightened, see?"
"I see," lied Strike, continuing to take notes. "Well, I'll need your address if I'm going to investigate."
He half expected resistance, but Billy reached eagerly for the proffered pad and pen. A further gust of body odour reached Strike. Billy began to write, but suddenly seemed to think better of it.
"You won't come to Jimmy's place, though. He'll fucking tear me. You can't come to Jimmy's."
"No, no," said Strike soothingly. "I just need your address for my records."
Through the door came Denise's grating voice.
"I need someone here quicker than that. He's very disturbed."
"What's she saying?"
asked Billy. To Strike's chagrin, Billy suddenly ripped the top sheet from the pad, crumpled it, then began to touch nose and chest again, with his fist enclosing the paper.
"Don't worry about Denise," said Strike. "She's dealing with another client. Can I get you a drink, Billy?"
"Drink of what?"
"Tea or coffee?"
"Why?"
asked Billy.
The offer seemed to have made him even more suspicious.
"Why do you want me to drink something?"
"Only if you fancy it. Doesn't matter if you don't."
"I don't need medicine."
"I haven't got any medicine to give you," said Strike.
"I'm not mental. He strangled a kid and they buried it down in the dell by our dad's house, wrapped in a blanket. It was pink blanket. It wasn't my fault. I was only a kid. I didn't want to be there. I was just a little kid."
"How many years ago do you know?"
"Ages, years. Can't get it out of my head," said Billy,
his eyes burning in his thin face as the fist enclosing the piece of paper fluttered up and down, touching nose, touching chest.
"They buried her in a pink blanket down in the dell by me dad's house, but afterwards they said it was a boy."
"Where's your dad's house, Billy?"
"She won't let me back now. You could dig, though, you could go. Strangled her, they did,"
said Billy, fixing Strike with his haunted eyes.
"But Jimmy said it was a boy, strangled, up by the..."
There was a knock on the door. Before Strike could tell her not to enter, Denise had poked her head inside, much braver now that Strike was here, full of her own importance.
"They're coming,"
she said, with a look of exaggerated meaning that would have spooked a man far less jumpy than Billy.
"On their way now."
"Who's coming?"
demanded Billy, jumping up.
"Who's on their way?"
Denise whipped her head out of the room and closed the door. There was a soft thud against the wood, and Strike knew that she was leaning against it, trying to hold Billy in.
"She's just talking about a delivery I'm expecting," Strike said soothingly, getting to his feet. "Go on about the..."
"What have you done?"
yelped Billy, backing away towards the door, while he repeatedly touched nose and chest.
"Who's coming?"
"Nobody's coming," said Strike.
But Billy was already trying to push the door open. Meeting resistance, he flung himself hard against it. There was a shriek from outside as Denise was thrown aside. Before Strike could get out from around the desk, Billy had sprinted through the outer door. They heard him jumping down the metal stairs three at a time, and Strike, infuriated, knowing that he had no hope of catching a younger and, on the evidence, fitter man, turned and ran back into his office. Throwing up the sash window, he leaned outside just in time to see Billy whipping around the corner of the street out of sight.
"Bollocks!"
A man heading inside the guitar shop opposite stared around in some perplexity for the source of the noise. Strike withdrew his head and turned to glare at Denise, who was dusting herself down in the doorway to his office. Incredibly, she looked pleased with herself.
"I tried to hold him in," she said proudly.
"Yeah," said Strike, exercising considerable self-restraint. "I saw."
"The police are on their way."
"Fantastic.
Would you like a cup of tea?"
"No," he said through gritted teeth.
"Then I think I'll go and freshen up the bathroom," she said, adding in a whisper, "I don't think he used the flush."
Chapter 3 I fought out that fight alone, and in the completest secrecy. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. As she walked along the unfamiliar Deptford Street, Robin was raised to temporary light-heartedness, then wondered when she had last felt this way, and knew that it had been over a year. Energized and uplifted by the afternoon sunshine, the colourful shop fronts and general bustle and noise, she was currently celebrating the fact that she never need see the inside of the Villiers Trust Clinic again. Her therapist had been unhappy that she was terminating treatment. "We recommend a full course," she had said. "I know," Robin replied. "But, well, I'm sorry, I think this has done me as much good as it's going to." The therapist's smile had been chilly. "The CBT's been great," Robin had said. "It's really helped with the anxiety. I'm going to keep that up." She had taken a deep breath, eyes fixed on the woman's low-heeled Mary Jane's, then forced herself to look her in the eye. "But I'm not finding this part helpful." Another silence had ensued. After 5 sessions, Robin was used to them. In normal conversation, it would be considered rude or passive-aggressive to leave these long pauses and simply watch the other person, waiting for them to speak. But in psychodynamic therapy, she had learned, it was standard. Robin's doctor had given her a referral for free treatment on the NHS, but the waiting list had been so long that she had decided, with Matthew's tight-lipped support, to pay for treatment. Matthew, she knew, was barely refraining from saying that the ideal solution would be to give up the job that had landed her with PTSD, and which, in his view, paid far too poorly, considering the dangers to which she had been exposed. "You see," Robin had continued with a speech he had prepared, "my life is pretty much wall-to-wall with people who think they know what's best for me." "Well, yes," said the therapist, in a manner that Robin felt would have been considered condescending beyond the clinic walls. "We've discussed, and..." Robin was by nature conciliatory and polite. On the other hand, she had been urged repeatedly by the therapist to speak the unvarnished truth in this dingy little room with the spider plant in its dull green pot and the man-sized tissues on the low pine table. "And to be honest," she said, "you feel like just another of them." Another pause. "Well," said the therapist with a little laugh, "I'm here to help you reach your own conclusions about..." "Yes, but you do it by pushing me all the time," said Robin. "It's combative. You challenge everything I say." Robin closed her eyes as a great wave of weariness swept her. Her muscles ached. She had spent all week putting together flat-pack furniture, heaving around boxes of books and hanging pictures. "I come out of here," said Robin, opening her eyes again, "feeling wrung out. I go home to my husband, and he does it too. He leaves big sulky silences and challenges me on the smallest thing. Then I phone my mother, and it's more of the same. The only person who isn't at me all the time to sort myself out is..." She pulled up short, then said, "Is my work partner." "Mr. Strike," said the therapist sweetly. It had been a matter of contention between Robin and the therapist that she had refused to discuss her relationship with Strike, other than to confirm that he was unaware of how much the Shacklewell Ripper case had affected her. Their personal relationship, she had stated firmly, was irrelevant to her present issues. The therapist had raised him in every session since, but Robin had consistently refused to engage on the subject. "Yes," said Robin. "Him." "By your own admission, you haven't told him the full extent of your anxiety." "So," said Robin, ignoring the last comment, "I really only came today to tell you I'm leaving. As I say, I found the CBT really useful, and I'm going to keep using the exercises." The therapist had seemed outraged that Robin wasn't even prepared to stay for the full hour, but Robin had paid for the entire session, and therefore felt free to walk out, giving her what felt like a bonus hour in the day. She felt justified in not hurrying home to do more unpacking, but to buy herself a cornetto and enjoy it as she wandered through the sun-drenched streets of her new area. Chasing her own cheerfulness like a butterfly, because she was afraid it might escape, she turned up a quieter street, forcing herself to concentrate, to take in the unfamiliar scene. She was, after all, delighted to have left behind the old flat in West Ealing with its many bad memories. It had become clear during his trial that the Shacklewell Ripper had been tailing and watching Robin for far longer than she had ever suspected. The police had even told her that they thought he had hung around Hastings Road, lurking behind parked cars, yards from her front door. Desperate though she had been to move, it had taken her and Matthew 11 months to find a new place. The main problem was that Matthew had been determined to take a step up the property ladder, now that he had a better-paid new job and a legacy from his late mother. Robin's parents, too, had expressed a willingness to help them, given the awful associations of the old flat. But London was excruciatingly expensive. 3 times had Matthew set his heart on flats that were, realistically, well out of their price range. 3 times had they failed to buy what Robin could have told him would sell for thousands more than they could offer. "It's ridiculous," he kept saying. "It isn't worth that." "It's worth whatever people are prepared to pay," Robin had said, frustrated that an accountant didn't understand the operation of market forces. She had been ready to move anywhere, even a single room, to escape the shadow of the killer who continued to haunt her dreams. On the point of doubling back towards the main road, her eye was caught by the opening in a brick wall, which was flanked by gateposts topped with the strangest finials she had ever seen. A pair of gigantic, crumbling stone skulls sat on top of carved bones on gateposts, beyond which a tall square tower rose. The finials would have looked at home, Robin thought, moving closer to examine the empty black eye sockets, garnishing the front of a pirate's mansion in some fantasy film. Peering through the opening, Robin saw a church and mossy tombs lying amid an empty rose garden in full bloom. She finished her ice cream while wandering around St. Nicholas's, a strange amalgam of an old red brick school grafted onto the rough stone tower. Finally, she sat down on a wooden bench that had grown almost uncomfortably hot in the sun, stretched her aching back, drank in the delicious scent of warm roses, and was suddenly transported, entirely against her will, back to the hotel suite in Yorkshire, almost a year ago, where a blood-red bouquet of roses had witnessed the aftermath of her abandonment of Matthew on the dance floor at her wedding reception. Matthew, his father, his Aunt Sue, Robin's parents and brother Stephen had all converged on the bridal suite where Robin had retreated to escape Matthew's fury. She had been changing out of her wedding dress when they had burst in, one after another, all demanding to know what was going on. A cacophony had ensued. Stephen, first to grasp what Matthew had done in deleting Strike's calls, started to shout at him. Geoffrey was drunkenly demanding to know why Strike had been allowed to stay for dinner, given he hadn't RSVP'd. Matthew was bellowing at all of them to butt out, that this was between him and Robin, while Aunt Sue said over and over,
"I've never seen a bride walk out of her first dance. Never, I've never seen a bride walk out of her first dance."
Then Linda had finally grasped what Matthew had done, and began telling him off too. Geoffrey had leapt to his son's defence, demanding to know why Linda wanted her daughter to go back to a man who allowed her to get stabbed. Martin had arrived, extremely drunk, and had taken a swing at Matthew for reasons that nobody had ever explained satisfactorily. And Robin had retreated to the bathroom where, incredibly, given that she had barely eaten all day, she had thrown up. 5 minutes later, she had been forced to let Matthew in because his nose was bleeding, and there, with their families still shouting at each other in the next-door bedroom, Matthew had asked her, a wadge of toilet roll pressed to his nostrils, to come with him to the Maldives, not as a honeymoon, not any more, but to sort things out in private, away, as he put it thickly, gesturing towards the source of the yelling, "From this. And there'll be press," he added accusingly. "They'll be after you. For the Ripper business." He was cold-eyed over the bloody toilet paper, furious with her for humiliating him on the dance floor, livid with Martin for hitting him. There was nothing romantic in his invitation to board the plane. He was proposing a summit, a chance for calm discussion. If, after serious consideration, they came to the conclusion that the marriage was a mistake, they would come home at the end of the fortnight, make a joint announcement, and go their separate ways. And at that moment, the wretched Robin, arm throbbing, shaken to the core by the feelings that had risen inside when she had felt Strike's arms around her, knowing that the press might even now be trying to track her down, had seen Matthew, if not as an ally, at least as an escape. The idea of getting on a plane, of flying out of reach of the tsunami of curiosity, gossip, anger, solicitude and unsought advice that she knew would engulf her as long as she remained in Yorkshire, was deeply appealing. So they had left, barely speaking during the flight. What Matthew had been thinking through those long hours, she had never inquired. She knew only that she had thought about Strike. Over and again, she had returned to the memory of their embrace as she watched the clouds slide past the window. "Am I in love with him?" she had asked herself repeatedly, but without reaching any firm conclusion. Her deliberations on the subject had lasted days, an inner torment she could not reveal to Matthew as they walked on white beaches, discussing the tensions and resentments that lay between the two of them. Matthew slept on the living room sofa at night, Robin in the net-draped double bed upstairs. Sometimes they argued, at other times they retreated into hurt and furious silences. Matthew was keeping tabs on Robin's phone, wanting to know where it was, constantly picking it up and checking it, and she knew that he was looking for messages or calls from her boss. What made things worse was that there were none. Apparently Strike wasn't interested in talking to her. The hug on the stairs, to which her thoughts kept scampering back like a dog to a blissfully pungent lamppost, seemed to have meant far less to him than it had to her. Night after night, Robin walked by herself on the beach, listening to the sea's deep breathing, her injured arm sweating beneath its rubber protective brace, her phone left at the villa so that Matthew had no excuse to tail her and find out whether she was talking secretly to Strike. But on the seventh night, with Matthew back at the villa, she had decided to call Strike. Almost without acknowledging it to herself, she had formulated a plan. There was a landline at the bar, and she knew the office number off by heart. It would be diverted to Strike's mobile automatically. What she was going to say when she reached him, she didn't know, but she was sure that if she heard him speak, the truth about her feelings would be revealed to her. As the phone rang in distant London, Robin's mouth had become dry. The phone was answered, but nobody spoke for a few seconds. Robin listened to the sounds of movement, then heard a giggle, and then at last somebody spoke.
"Hello, this is Cormy Warmy."
As the woman broke into loud, raucous laughter, Robin heard Strike somewhere in the background, half amused, half annoyed, and certainly drunk.
"Gimme that. Seriously, give it."
Robin had slammed the receiver back onto its rest. Sweat had broken out on her face and chest. She felt ashamed, foolish, humiliated. He was with another woman. The laughter had been unmistakably intimate. The unknown girl had been teasing him, answering his mobile, calling him, how revolting, "Cormy." She would deny phoning him, she resolved, if ever Strike asked her about the dropped call. She would lie through her teeth, pretend not to know what he was talking about. The sound of the woman on the phone had affected her like a hard slap. If Strike could have taken somebody to bed so soon after their hug, and she would have staked her life on the fact that the girl, whoever she was, had either just slept with Strike or was about to, then he wasn't sitting in London torturing himself about his true feelings for Robin Ellicott. The salt on her lips made her thirsty as she trudged through the night, wearing a deep groove in the soft white sand as the waves broke endlessly beside her. Wasn't it possible, she asked herself, when she was cried out last night, that she was confusing gratitude and friendship with something deeper? That she had mistaken her love of detection for love of the man who had given her the job? She admired Strike, of course, and was immensely fond of him. They had passed through many intense experiences together, so that it was natural to feel close to him. But was that love? Alone in the balmy, mosquito-buzzing night, while the waves sighed on the shore and she cradled her aching arm, Robin reminded herself bleakly that she had had very little experience with men for a woman approaching her 28th birthday. Matthew was all she had ever known, her only sexual partner, a place of safety to her for 10 long years now. If she had developed a crush on Strike, she employed the old-fashioned word her mother might have used, mightn't it also be the natural side effect of the lack of variety and experimentation most women of her age had enjoyed. For so long faithful to Matthew, hadn't she been bound to look up one day and remember that there were other lives, other choices? Hadn't she been long overdue to notice that Matthew was not the only man in the world? Strike, she told herself, was simply the one with whom she had been spending the most time. So naturally, it had been he onto whom she projected her wondering, her curiosity, her dissatisfaction with Matthew. Having, as she told herself, talked sense into that part of her that kept yearning for Strike, she reached a hard decision on the eighth evening of her honeymoon. She wanted to go home early and announce their separation to their families. She must tell Matthew that it had nothing to do with anybody else, but after agonizing and serious reflection, she did not believe they were well suited enough to continue in the marriage. She could still remember her feeling of mingled panic and dread as she had pushed open the cabin door, braced for a fight that had never materialized. Matthew had been sitting slumped on the sofa, and when he saw her, he mumbled, "Mom." His face, arms and legs had been shining with sweat. As she moved towards him, she saw an ugly black tracing of veins up the inside of his left arm, as though somebody had filled them with ink. "Matt?" Hearing her, he had realized that she was not his dead mother.
"Don't feel well, Rob."
She had dashed for the phone, called the hotel, asked for a doctor. By the time he arrived, Matthew was drifting in and out of delirium. They had found the scratch on the back of his hand and, worried, concluded that he might have cellulitis, which Robin could tell from the faces of the worried doctor and nurse was serious. Matthew kept seeing figures moving in the shadowy corners of the cabin, people who weren't there.
"Who's that?"
he kept asking Robin.
"Who's that over there?"
"There's nobody else here, Matt." Now she was holding his hand while the nurse and doctor discussed hospitalization.
"Don't leave me, Rob."
"I'm not going to leave you." She had meant that she was going nowhere just now, not that she would stay forever. But Matthew had begun to cry.
"Oh, thank God. I thought you were going to walk. I love you, Rob. I know I fucked up, but I love you."
The doctor gave Matthew oral antibiotics and went to make telephone calls. Delirious, Matthew clung to his wife, thanking her. Sometimes he drifted into a state where, again, he thought he saw shadows moving in the empty corners of the room, and twice more he muttered about his dead mother. Alone in the velvety blackness of the tropical night, Robin listened to winged insects colliding with the screens at the windows, alternately comforting and watching over the man she had loved since she was 17. It hadn't been cellulitis. The infection had responded over the next 24 hours to antibiotics. As he recovered from the sudden violent illness, Matthew watched her constantly, weak and vulnerable as she had never seen him, afraid, she knew, that her promise to stay had been temporary.
"We can't throw it all away, can we?"
he had asked her hoarsely, from the bed where the doctor had insisted he stay.
"All these years."
She had let him talk about the good times, the shared times, and she had reminded herself about the giggling girl who had called Strike Cormie. She envisioned going home and asking for an annulment because the marriage had still not been consummated. She remembered the money her parents had spent on the wedding day she had hated. Bees buzzed in the churchyard roses around her as Robin wondered for the thousandth time where she would be right now if Matthew hadn't scratched himself on coral. Most of her now terminated therapy sessions had been full of her need to talk about the doubts that had plagued her ever since she had agreed to remain married. In the months that had followed, and especially when she and Matthew were getting on reasonably well, it seemed to her that it had been right to give the marriage a fair trial. But she never forgot to think of it in terms of a trial, and this in itself sometimes led her, sleepless at night, to castigate herself for the pusillanimous failure to pull herself free once Matthew had recovered. She had never explained to Strike what had happened, why she had agreed to try and keep the marriage afloat. Perhaps that was why their friendship had grown so cold and distant. When she had returned from her honeymoon, it was to find Strike changed towards her. And perhaps she acknowledged she had changed towards him too, because of what she had heard on the line when she had called, in desperation, from the Maldives bar.
"Sticking with it then, are you?"
he said roughly, after a glance at her ring finger. His tone had nettled her, as had the fact that he had never asked why she was trying, never asked about her home life from that point onwards, never so much as hinted that he remembered the hug on the stairs. Whether because Strike had arranged matters that way or not, they had not worked a case together since that of the Shacklewell Ripper. Imitating her senior partner, Robin had retreated into a cool professionalism. But sometimes she was afraid that he no longer valued her as he once had, now that she had proven herself so conventional and cowardly. There had been an awkward conversation a few months ago in which he had suggested that she take time off, asked whether she felt she was fully recovered after the knife attack. Taking this as a slight upon her bravery, afraid that she would again find herself sidelined, losing the only part of her life that she currently found fulfilling, she had insisted that she was perfectly well and redoubled her professional efforts. The muted mobile in her bag vibrated. Robin slipped her hand inside and looked to see who was calling. Strike. She also noticed that he had called earlier when she was saying a joyful goodbye to the Villiers Trust Clinic.
"Hi," she said. "I missed you earlier, sorry."
"Not a problem. Move gone all right?"
"Fine," she said.
"Just wanted to let you know, I've hired us a new subcontractor, name of Sam Barkley."
"Great," said Robin, watching a fly shimmering on a fat blush-pink rose. "What's his background?"
"Army," said Strike.
"Military police?"
Not exactly."
As he told her the story of Sam Barkley, Robin found herself grinning.
"So you've hired a dope-smoking painter and decorator?"
"Vaping. Dope vaping," Strike corrected her. And Robin could tell that he was grinning too. "He's on a health kick, new baby."
"Well, he sounds interesting."
She waited, but Strike did not speak.
"I'll see you Saturday night, then," she said.
Robin had felt obliged to invite Strike to her and Matthew's housewarming party, because she had given their most regular and reliable subcontractor, Andy Hutchins, an invitation, and felt it would be odd to leave out Strike. She had been surprised when he had accepted.
"Yeah, see you then."
"Is Lorelei coming?"
Robin asked, striving for casualness, but not sure she had succeeded. Back in central London, Strike thought he detected a sardonic note in the question, as though challenging him to admit that his girlfriend had a ludicrous moniker. He would once have pulled her up on it, asked what her problem was with the name Lorelei, enjoyed sparring with her. But this was dangerous territory.
"Yes, she's coming. The invitation was to both."
"Yes, of course it was," said Robin hastily. "All right, I'll see you—"
"Hang on," said Strike.
He was alone in the office because he had sent Denise home early. The temp had not wanted to leave. She was paid by the hour, after all, and only after Strike had assured her that he would pay for a full day had she gathered up all her possessions, talking non-stop all the while.
"Funny thing happened this afternoon," said Strike.
Robin listened intently without interrupting to Strike's vivid account of the brief visit of Billy. By the end of it, she had forgotten to worry about Strike's coolness. Indeed, he now sounded like the Strike of a year ago.
"He was definitely mentally ill," said Strike,
his eyes on the clear sky beyond the window.
"Possibly psychotic."
"Yeah, but—"
"I know," said Strike.
He picked up the pad from which Billy had ripped his half-written address and turned it absently in his free hand.
"Is he mentally ill, so he thinks he saw a kid strangled, or is he mentally ill and he saw a kid strangled?"
Neither spoke for a while, during which time both turned over Billy's story in their minds knowing that the other was doing the same. This brief, companionable spell of reflection ended abruptly when a cocker spaniel, which Robin had not noticed as it came snuffling through the roses, laid its cold nose without warning on her bare knee, and she shrieked,
"What the fuck?"
"Nothing, a dog."
"Where are you?"
"In a graveyard."
"What? Why?"
"Just exploring the area. I better go," she said, getting to her feet. "There's another flat pack waiting for me at home."
"Right you are," said Strike, with a return to his usual briskness. "See you Saturday."
"I'm so sorry," said the Cocker Spaniel's elderly owner, as Robin slid her mobile back into her bag. "Are you frightened of dogs?"
"Not at all," said Robin, smiling and patting the dog's soft golden head. "He surprised me, that's all."
As she headed back past the giant skulls towards her new home, Robin thought about Billy, whom Strike had described with such vividness that Robin felt as though she had met him too. So deeply absorbed in her thoughts was she, that for the first time all week, Robin forgot to glance up at the White Swan pub as she passed it. High above the street, on the corner of the building, was a single carved swan, which reminded Robin, every time she passed it, of her calamitous wedding day. Chapter 4 "But what do you propose to do in the town, then?" Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. 6.5 miles away, Strike set his mobile down on his desk and lit a cigarette. Robin's interest in his story had been soothing after the interview he had endured half an hour after Billy had fled. The two policemen who had answered Denise's call had seemed to relish their opportunity to make the famous Cormoran Strike admit his fallibility, taking their time as they ascertained that he had succeeded in finding out neither full name nor address of the probably psychotic Billy. The late afternoon sun hit the notebook on his desk at an angle, revealing faint indentations. Strike dropped his cigarette into an ashtray he had stolen long ago from a German bar, picked up the notepad and tilted it this way and that, trying to make out the letters formed by the impressions, then reached for a pencil and lightly shaded over them. Untidy capital letters were soon revealed, clearly spelling the words Charlemont Road. Billy had pressed less hard on the house or flat number than the street name. One of the faint indents looked like either a 5 or an incomplete 8, but the spacing suggested more than one figure, or possibly a letter. Strike's incurable predilection for getting to the root of puzzling incidents tended to inconvenience him quite as much as other people. Hungry and tired though he was, and despite the fact that he had sent his temp away so he could shut up the office, he tore the paper carrying the revealed name off the pad and headed into the outer room, where he switched the computer back on. There were several Charlemont Roads in the UK, but on the assumption that Billy was unlikely to have the means to travel very far, he suspected that the one in East Ham had to be the right one. Online records showed 2 Williams living there, but both were over 60. Remembering that Billy had been scared that Strike might turn up at Jimmy's place, he had searched for Jimmy and then James, which turned up the details of James Faraday, 49. Strike made a note of Faraday's address beneath Billy's indented scribbles, though not at all confident that Faraday was the man he sought. For one thing, his house number contained no 5s or 8s, and for another, Billy's extreme unkemptness suggested that whomever he lived with must take a fairly relaxed attitude to his personal hygiene. Faraday lived with a wife and what appeared to be 2 daughters. Strike turned off the computer, but continued to stare abstractedly at the dark screen, thinking about Billy's story. It was the detail of the pink blanket that kept nagging at him. It seemed such a specific, unglamorous detail for a psychotic delusion. Remembering that he needed to be up early in the morning for a paying job, he pulled himself to his feet. Before leaving the office, he inserted the piece of paper bearing both the impressions of Billy's handwriting and Faraday's address into his wallet. London which had recently been at the epicentre of the Queen's Diamond Jubilee celebrations, was preparing to host the Olympics. Union Jacks and the London 2012 logo were everywhere,